Osho, Philosophia Perennis, Volume 1. Talks on Pythagoras, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 3.
The first question, Bhagwan. Thank you for the delicate synthesis. Great joy arises in understanding the purposelessness of existence. Deva Nirguna, truth always triggers a process in you. Even if the truth is not your own, the very hearing of it creates a parallel process in you. It is not caused by hearing it. It follows not the law of cause and effect, but the law of synchronicity. Listening to great music, music arises in you. There is no necessity. It may arise, it may not arise. There is no inevitability about it. But if you are open, it arises. If you are available, it arises. Watching a great dancer, something starts dancing in you. This is communion. The truth of Pythagoras, the truth of the greatest synthesis ever attempted, can trigger a process in you. Can start something so immense that you could not have ever dreamt about it. That is the whole purpose of satsang, being in communion with a master. His presence, his utterances, his silences start working on you. And sometimes even in spite of you. Sometimes you become aware of those processes, sometimes not even aware of. They start working underneath your consciousness. One day they explode into great blossoming. Pythagoras really has tried the impossible. And not only tried, he succeeded too. But the world wants to live in division. Because the world can only understand conflict. It cannot understand synthesis. Synthesis can be understood only when some synthesis inside you starts happening. Otherwise, synthesis is non-understandable, will be misunderstood. Everybody was against Pythagoras. All religions, all sects, all so-called gurus of those days were against Pythagoras. In fact, this should have been with him, because he was bringing all scattered fragments of truth together. But it hurts if I say Quran is true, as much true as the Vedas. If people were understanding, then Mohammedans and Hindus will both be tremendously happy. But that doesn't happen. Both become angry. The Mohammedan becomes angry because I have compared his holy book with the ordinary book, Vedas. And the Hindu becomes angry because I have compared his holy book with an ordinary book, Quran. They both become angry because their egos are hurt. And you can understand what must have happened to Pythagoras, because it is happening to me. It is happening to you. The same process. Hindus are against, Mohammedans are against, Jainas are against, Buddhists are against, Christians are against. Why? And I am bringing Christ and Buddha and Mahavira and Zarathustra and Lao Tzu and Krishna in the highest possible synthesis. Still they are all against it. The reason is they are divided within themselves. They can only understand that which they are. You can never understand anything beyond your consciousness. If you are split, you can only understand the split world. If you are in a subtle harmony inside, then only any harmony happening outside will be understood. It is good, Nirguna, that you felt great gratitude arising in you, listening to the synthesis. It shows something has started becoming integrated in you. Something that is bringing you together, that is creating a kind of unity between your two hemispheres of the brain, the left and the right. These two hemispheres of the brain have to be understood, and very deeply, because much depends on that. Now, scientists are also in deep agreement with the ancient mystic lore that unless these two brains are bridged and bridged rightly, a man remains schizophrenic. They are bridged, but in a very, very small way. Just a small thread bridges them. That thread can be cut. Sometimes it happens in an accident, in a car accident, for example. The bridge may be damaged. It is very delicate bridge. Just like a thread. Once it is cut, the person becomes two persons. One person becomes two persons. He starts behaving like two persons. And strange things have been observed. For example, the left side of the brain is capable to read and to remember. The right side of the brain is not able to read at all. So a strange thing happens. You can give the person to read something, he will read. But only one part of his brain will remember it. If you anesthetize his left side, he will not even remember that he has read anything. He has read something, but he will not remember. His one hand may be doing something, but the other hand will not cooperate. Because those two hands belong to different hemispheres. The right hand belongs to the left hemisphere. That's why right hand has become so important. Right has become the right hand, and the left hand has become the wrong hand. Why? It is very symbolic. Left hand is connected with the right hemisphere, and the right hemisphere represents intuition, psychic powers, meditation, love, poetry. Because all these things are condemned, left hand is condemned. The right hand represents logic, calculation, arithmetic, science. Because these things are praised, right hand is praised. Ten 10% children are born left-handed. Out of 10, 1% is left-handed. You may not be able to find so many people left-handed, because from the very beginning we start forcing them to write by the right hand, do things by the right hand. This is destroying a minority. This is very oppressive. Because the person who is born left-handed has to be left-handed if he is to be ever an authentic person. He will become phony. You will force him to use the right hand, and because all are rightists, the teacher, the parents, other students in this school, he will feel guilty to use the left hand. He is doing something wrong. He is not doing anything wrong. He is naturally a leftist. He has the capacity to become a poet. He has the capacity to become an intuitive person. He may develop prophetic powers. He may be able one day to read other people's thoughts. He may be able to become a great hypnotic medium. He may be able even to have power of mind over matters. He has immense capacities, but he is crushed. The society forces him to move to the right hand. Right hand is his weak hand. He will live a very weak life, unfertile, uncreative. He may have become a great seer. Now he will live just as a third-rate mathematician. The person may have been a first-rate poet, or a musician, or a painter. Now he will be just a third-rate clerk in some office, or a station master, or a deputy collector, or a politician, something third-rate. You have been very, very violent with him. These two hemispheres are very slightly bridged. A little communication happens ordinarily. The more one becomes integrated, deeper communication starts happening between these two hemispheres. In a Buddha, those two hemispheres become one. He is as logical as one can be and as loving as one can be. The left hemisphere, which is connected with the right hand, is under the law of necessity. And the right hemisphere, which is connected with the left hand, is under the law of power. And if both these laws become one, logos arises, dhamma arises, tao, Torah arises, the ultimate law, the law of laws. Then the man has a tremendous beauty and grace. He is the meeting of the earth and the sky, of man and woman. He is the meeting of all that is divided in existence. And in that meeting, God is known. All the secret methods of all the mystery schools are nothing but alchemical processes to create a bridge between these two hemispheres, to bring them so close, so utterly close, that they almost become one. When logic functions as love, love functions as logic, you have attained to the highest peak. At that peak, ecstasy simply happens. Just as when spring comes, flowers start blossoming. When that synthesis, that spring has happened into your inner world, you have come home. You have attained the one, the whole. You have become holy. Nirguna, something is happening in you, as something is happening to all of my sannyasins, those who are really close to me, those who are not just formally sannyasins, those who are really in love with me. Those who have really said a yes to me without any no hiding behind it. This synthesis is happening. East and west are meeting. Sky and the earth are meeting. Matter and mind are meeting. What Pythagoras did was destroyed. His whole academy, his whole school was burnt. Hundreds of his disciples were massacred. We are trying to do it again. We are taking the risk again. The danger is there. The same can be our fate too. But it need not be. We can learn something from Pythagoras' experiment. He was the first pioneer. He had succeeded in his life. He had succeeded with many of his disciples. But maybe he had come too early. The world was not yet ready. Now the world is scientifically ready. That time the world was not scientifically ready. East was east and west was west, and the bridge was almost impossible. Now the science has brought people so close to each other that this is the climate. Spiritually also a synthesis is possible. At that time people were isolated. Once in a while a visitor may come from the west to the east. And remember, it was always a visitor from the west to the east. It was never a visitor from the east to the west. Why? West represents the male mind. It takes initiative. East represents the female mind. It simply waits. It takes no initiative. It is like a man always proposes to the woman and says, I love you. It is never the woman who proposes. And if a woman proposes to you, you would like to escape from her, because she is not a woman. She has more of a male mind. You will become afraid. You will be offended. You will not be able to take it easily. The woman has to wait. That's why the West has always been sending feelers to the East. The East has simply waited. It has not gone anywhere. Once in a while, a visitor may come. He will take with him the ancient lore of the East to the West. And he will always be misunderstood. It happened with Pythagoras, and after 500 years it happened with Jesus. Jesus had also been a visitor to the East. He learned all in the East. And when he went back, he was not understood either. It was too foreign. The same way it is happening to my sannyasins. When you go to the West, you are going to be misunderstood. But you are in a better position. You are so many. A Pythagoras came alone, went back alone. A Jesus came alone, went back alone. They were great adventurers. Jesus was killed. Pythagoras' academy was burnt. His disciples massacred. The world was not yet so closely knit as it is today. Science and technology has brought people very close. All the barriers, at least physical barriers, are removed. Now the second step can be taken. Psychological barriers can be removed. That's what we are doing here. It is good that the Pythagorean synthesis struck a chord in your heart, because that's my work too. And second thing, Nirguna, you say, great joy arises in understanding the purposelessness of existence. Joy arises only when you understand that the whole cannot have any purpose. Parts can have purpose. The whole cannot have any purpose. Your house has a purpose. It is a center for you, a safety for you. The food has a purpose. It nourishes you. It keeps you alive. Your clothes are purposeful. Your machines and everything that you create is purposeful. But what purpose you have? Now you start moving into the world of purposelessness. It's still few things you can find. You can say, I am here to be happy. But what purpose is there in being happy? What purpose happiness has? You may say, I am here to love. But then love in itself is purposeless. It is as purposeless as a rose flower. as a dewdrop is slipping on the lotus leaf in the early morning sun. It is as purposeless as the whole. The closer you come to the whole, purposelessness becomes the law. Purpose belongs to the law of necessity. Purposelessness belongs to the law of power. What is the purpose of the whole? No purpose at all. It is a sheer celebration. That's why Hindus have called it Leela. Leela means a playfulness. It is just a play. Play has no purpose. The moment play becomes purposeful, it becomes a game. Remember, that is the difference between play and game. If you are simply playing cards with no stick, with no money involved, it is a play. The moment you stake money, it is no more play, it is business. Purpose has entered. It is a game. Now you are gambling. Just a few moments before you were playing. Now playing has become secondary. Now the question is how to succeed in getting more money. The thing has become serious. It is no more weightless. It has fallen from the world of grace into the world of gravitation. It has fallen from the world of power into the world of necessity. These two laws are tremendously beautiful. The law of necessity is equivalent to law of gravitation. Science has recognized the law of gravitation. The law of necessity. Science has not yet recognized the higher law, the law of grace, the law of power. That's why science goes on thinking in terms of cause and effect. It is still unaware of a higher law. Religion has discovered the higher law. The law of grace. Gravitation pulls you down. Now this should be meditated over. If there is birth, there is death. To counterbalance it. If there is love, there is hate. If there is negative electricity, there is positive electricity. If there is a law that pulls things down, there must be a law that pulls things up. It is a simple logic. It need not be proved. It is very simple. In life, everything is balanced by its polar opposite. So where is the polar opposite of gravitation, I ask? There must be. And remember, even gravitation was not known before Newton. Just only for 300 years we have known it. And it is not that the law of gravitation started functioning after Newton. It was functioning forever. Newton has not invented it. He only discovered it. And now the discovery looks very ordinary. Newton sitting under a tree and an apple falls. And he contemplates over it. Why the apple always falls downwards? Why not sometimes upwards? Or right, or left? Just going in any direction. Why it always comes downwards? And something clicked in his mind. That there must be some power that pulls it towards the earth. But apples have been falling always, before Newton too. Apples don't bother whether Newton has discovered the law or not. Apples have been simply falling without knowing any signs of falling. And exactly the same has been happening with the law of grace. There have been people who have been falling upwards. A Buddha, a Jesus, a Pythagoras. These people have fallen upwards. They know that something pulls up if you allow. If you simply become effortless, if you don't do a thing, if you surrender, if you trust, something starts taking you upwards. You start levitating, not physically, spiritually. Something in you starts rising higher and higher and higher and reaches to the ultimate peak of consciousness. Just as the apple falls downwards, you start falling upwards. There is a famous Sufi parable. A Sufi mystic who was known as a madman. Many mystics have been known as madmen. They are in a sense. The world thinks they are mad because they follow something utterly absurd in the eyes of the world. The world accumulates money. The world is in search of more and more power and prestige. And they simply are not concerned with these great things. The world wants to possess and have more and more. And there have been people who are not worried of having more and more. Certainly they look mad. They don't have a thing with them. Remember Diogenes. Not having a thing with himself. But is still happier than Alexander the Great. Utterly joyous. Even Alexander the Great had felt jealous. It is said that he said to Diogenes that if next time I have to come in the world, I will ask God, this time please make me Diogenes. I don't want to become Alexander the Great again. Must have felt very jealous of Diogenes, the naked madman. But what Diogenes said, he laughed and he said, if I have another chance to come into the world, I cannot ask to be made Alexander the Great because I am not stupid. And why do you want to wait for another life? You can become Diogenes right now. Because to become an Alexander Great, effort is needed. To become a Diogenes, no effort is needed. You can become immediately. He said, throw your clothes. Lie down by my side. I am taking a sun bath. You take it also. And forget all about conquering the world. You are a Diogenes this very moment. These people will look mad. He used to look mad. Diogenes used to carry a lamp in the full daylight. And whenever he meet a person, he will take his lamp up and look into his face in the full daylight. And people will ask, what are you doing? And he will say, I am searching for a man. I have not come across yet. And do you know what happened when he died? Somebody asked Diogenes, your whole life you have been searching for a real man. Even in full daylight, with a lamp. Did you find him? Diogenes opened his eyes and he said, no, but I am dying happy. At least nobody has stolen my lamp yet. These people will look mad. The story, Sufi story, says a mad Sufi mystic stayed in the house of a disciple. The disciple was a little worried because this man was known to do strange things. He may do something and may create some nuisance in the neighborhood. And the people, what they will think that I am also mad to be a disciple of such a madman. And it was known that even in the middle of the night he will start singing, shouting, out of joy or dancing. So the disciple thought it will be better to keep him locked in the basement. So at least not in the middle of the night he starts doing something. So he locked him in the basement. And just in the middle of the night, it started happening. A great rejoicing, shouting and dancing. And he were more puzzled because he heard him dancing on the roof. He rushed upwards. He asked, but how you managed? How you came to the roof? He said, what can I do? I opened my eyes and I saw I was falling upwards. This is a beautiful story. Falling upwards. There is a law of falling upwards. And when sometimes you meditate, dance, sing, you will feel it. Being purchased by something higher from the above, and you are taking to higher plenitudes that you have ever known before. That is the law of grace or the law of power. And when you can use both the worlds, one belongs to the science, one belongs to the religion. And the world is waiting for a new way of looking at things in which science and religion will become one. Call it religio-science or call it science-religion. But something, the world is waiting that will make these two laws function as one. In a great synthesis. That's what I mean when I say that I would like my sannyasins to be like Zorba the Greek and Gautam the Buddha, both together. My effort here is to create Zorba the Buddha. The second question, Bhagwan, I love the way your hands move and dance gracefully while you are talking to us. I feel intoxicated with your hands and their expressive movements. What is the secret of your hands? There is no secret. I am just an old ancient Jew. And habits die hard. It was a morning in December, and the air was bitter cold. Two Jews were walking down the sidewalk, and one of the pair, amid great puffs of steaming breath, was talking and gesticulating earnestly. The other, however, remained silent. Finally, the first Jew paused in his discourse long enough to say, "Well, Mo, don't you agree with me? What I say?" To which Mo replied, "Ikey, you can talk all you want, but I am going to keep my hands in my pockets." The third question: what is the deactivation process of the law of necessity and the activation process of the law of power? Anurag, the law of necessity means you are unconscious. You are functioning like a robot. Only then the law of necessity applies. So if you want to deactivatize the law of necessity, the only way is to become more aware, more alert. De-automatize your activities. Walking, walk with awareness. Eating, eat with awareness. In the beginning, it is very difficult because you have always lived in unconsciousness. You walk mechanically. Bring awareness to walking. And to bring awareness to walking, few things will be needed. One, don't walk at the usual pace you walk. Go slower. Go as slow as you can. Because if you go slower than you usually go, your old habit cannot persist. You are bringing something new in it, and the body will have to get adjusted. It will take time, and that time can be used to become aware. If you smoke cigarettes, go very slowly. Take time. Take the pocket of the cigarettes very slowly from your pocket. As slowly as possible. Be in slow motion. And then slowly take a cigarette out, very slowly, as if you have no energy. And you are bound to be aware. Then tape the cigarette on the pocket. As slowly as possible, that you are almost dead. And go on doing it for a longer time. Then very slowly put it in your mouth. Then wait. Don't be in a hurry. Then bring your lighters. And the same is slow. Take time. Smoke one cigarette in 1 hour. And you will be surprised how much awareness arises in you. And you will be also surprised to know, the moment you lose awareness, you fall back into the old fast motion. Slow down. That's the whole process of vipassana. In vipassana, you have to do 2 kinds of meditation. One is sitting, zazen. It can be done in any way. Just breathe very slowly. And breathing becomes a meditation. Let your hand move very slowly from one side to the other. And you will be aware. Make your activities de-automatize. And the more aware you are, the more the law of necessity starts disappearing. And when there is no law of necessity functioning, the other law functions automatically on its own accord, the law of power. It is said, one day a great astrologer who was coming back from Kashi, he has been learning astrology for 20 years in Kashi. He has become very famous. Now he is going back to his hometown. Passing a river, on the soft, wet sand, he saw few footprints. He could not believe his eyes. Those footprints can only be of a man who is the ruler of the whole world. That's what his astrological books had been telling him for 20 years. The ruler of the whole world has a special name in India. He is called Chakravarti, whose rule is on all the 6 continents. What a Chakravartin is doing in this poor village, naked, barefooted, in the hot sun. Impossible. A great doubt arose in the astrologer. Are my books wrong? He studied the footprint very well. All the symptoms are there. He followed those footprints in search of this man, and he came across Buddha sitting under a tree. Now there was even more difficulty. The man looked like a great emperor. His grace, his beauty, and the silence that surrounded him, and the festivity that was around, just by his presence, the tree was glowing, the rock he was sitting on was glowing. He is a Chakravarti, but he looks like a beggar too, with a begging bowl. He fell in the feet of Buddha and asked, "You have puzzled me very much. Should I throw my books? 20 years I have wasted. Can I see at your feet?" He looked at Buddha's feet and he said, "Now it is absolutely certain. You should be a Chakravartin, the greatest emperor in the world, the emperor of emperors. What are you doing here? I don't even see a servant around you. And what is this begging bowl? And these old clothes you are wearing? Are you a beggar?" Buddha laughed and he said, "Don't throw your books. They are right. But they are right only to the people, for the people who live under the law of necessity. Those who live unconsciously. Once a person becomes conscious, he goes beyond astrology and astrological predictions. Then the law of necessity no more applies to him. Then he is part of the infinite power. Then he is part of a God. He is a God. He lives in a totally different way. You cannot predict him. He is unpredictable. Don't throw your books. You will not come across a man like me again in your life. Don't be worried. It rarely happens. Very rarely it happens that a person is born as a Chakravartin. Very rarely it happens that a person becomes a Buddha.
And of course, absolutely rare it is the case when a Chakravartin becomes a Buddha. Chakravartin in itself is rare. Buddha in itself is rare. And the combination of a Chakravartin becoming a Buddha is absolutely rare. You will not come in this life across a person, or in many lives. So don't be worried. Your books, you can take your books. And you will always be right. This is only once that you have been wrong. Become conscious, Anurag. More conscious you are, more you are beyond prediction. Then you live each moment in freedom. Power means freedom. Power means free from the past karma. Power means you are no more dominated by the past. The past has no more power over you. Your each moment is free from the past moment. Your each moment is fresh, young, virgin. You live it in total freedom. But it never creates a bondage for the moment that will be following it. Your each moment remains unpolluted, pure, crystal clear. And to live in the law of necessity is to live in bondage. That's what is meant by sansara, the bondage, imprisoned. That is the whole meaning of the law of karma. In fact, the idea that Pythagoras got of the law of necessity is from the law of karma. That is his way of expressing it. The law of karma says whatever you have done in the past is still dominating you. You are possessed by the dead past. You are manipulated by the dead past. Whatsoever you have done yesterday has become a pattern, a structure, character. And you are simply repeating it today. By repeating it, you will be enforcing it. Tomorrow, it will become stronger. And day after tomorrow, more stronger. And life after life, if you go on repeating a certain thing, it creates grooves in your mind. And then it becomes absolute necessity. You simply live like a robot. Gurdjieff used to say that man is a machine. It is true. Unless you become a Buddha, you are a machine. What the word Buddha means? Buddha means one who is awakened, aware. Become aware. The man of awareness has no character. You will be surprised. I say the man of awareness is characterless. Not in the sense that you give to the word characterlessness, but in a totally different sense, he is characterless because he has no past to dominate, no structure, no pattern. He is pure freedom. He is innocent. He responds to the moment with no ready-made responses. Because if a response is ready-made, it is not a response at all. It is a reaction. He mirrors the moment as it is. And in that mirroring, he acts. The unconscious person reacts. The conscious person acts. And if you can act consciously, totally in the moment, you don't create any karma. You don't create any structures. You always remain free. You always go on moving beyond the past. You go on slipping out of the past like a snake slips out of the old skin. Then life has tremendous beauty. Because then there is power. And it is not your power. So there is no question of any ego trip. Ego comes from the past. It is part of the law of necessity. Ego is your character, good or bad, but ego is the prison that keeps you in bondage. Ego arises out of your whole past. Just think for a moment, if you had no past, who are you? Suddenly, the whole edifice of the ego collapses. The man of power is not really powerful in his own right. He is just a vehicle for the power of a God. He has no claims. He simply functions as a representative of the whole. He is utter freedom, utter joy. He knows no boundaries. He is infinite. Space and time are no more relevant to him. He is beyond space, beyond time. That is the meaning of being enlightened. Disappearing as a character, disappearing as a person, disappearing as an ego, and becoming one with the whole. Unio mystica. That mystic union, and you are no more there, and God is power. The bridge from necessity to power is consciousness. Anurag, become more and more conscious in whatsoever you are doing. And it is your birthright to enter into the world of power, into the radiant world of power, luminous world of power. The fourth question. Bhagwan, is it right time for me to become a sannyasin? Can I ask when it is right time? It happened on a journey by a ship. The parrot felt terribly bored and was really happy when one day he discovered that there was also a monkey on board. To pass the time, the parrot said, "Let us play hide and seek." The monkey said, "I don't know this game. How does it go?" So the parrot explained, "It is very simple. You close your eyes, face a wall, and count to 100. In the meantime, I hide, and when you reach 100, you start looking for me." So they did. But it happened that the ship exploded at the same moment that the monkey reached 100. The parrot managed to find a plank floating in the sea. After a while, he saw the monkey as he swam towards the plank, totally exhausted. When the monkey had climbed up, he looked at the parrot and said, "What a stupid game." Whenever you feel life as a stupid game, it is time for sannyas. The fifth question. Can you say something more about obedience?
Is it not good to serve obediently in a noble cause? Awareness is the only virtue with me, remember. If you serve with awareness, it is good. If you serve in an unconscious way, it is bad. It is not a question of a noble cause. If you are unconscious, even a noble cause is going to be very ignoble. It is the consciousness that you bring to it that matters. You can look in the history books. All kinds of mischiefs have continued on the earth in the name of noble causes. Christians, Mohammedans, Hindus have been fighting, destroying each other for noble causes. Fascists have been bringing more and more violence in the world and more murders for noble causes. Do you think Adolf Hitler's cause was not noble? If it was not noble, how a very intelligent race like Germans followed him? And remember that Germans are one of the most intelligent races on the world map. This age's four great minds who have dominated the whole world all have come from Germany. Friedrich Nietzsche, Sigmund Freud, Karl Marx, Albert Einstein. These are the four great names of our times. They all came from German mind, from German sources. How such intelligent people could follow this stupid megalomaniac Adolf Hitler in the name of a noble cause? The noble cause was, the world is in a chaos and the world has to be dominated and ruled by the noble people, by the Aryans. Do you know the word Arya means noble? The world has to be dominated and ruled by the noblest of the noble. Arya is a Sanskrit word. It means the noblest. Now, behind the word noble, Adolf Hitler is hiding all kinds of ugly things. And thousands of intelligent people followed him obediently because the cause was noble. Millions of Jews were burned in the name of a noble cause. Millions suffered in concentration camps. And the people who were torturing them were not unintelligent people. Were very efficient and intelligent people. And they were doing their duty obediently.
for a noble cause. What happened in Russia? Joseph Stalin, another man of the same type as Adolf Hitler. Again, in the name of a noble cause, communism has to be established. And any sacrifice is not much. If communism, the paradise, the classless society, can arrive on the earth, then no sacrifice is much. And the same has been happening down the ages. The Christian crusades, the Mohammedan jihads, wars of religion, to save religion. Of course, when Islam is in danger, it has to be saved, and the people who are creating the danger have to be destroyed in the name of a noble cause. When Christianity is in danger, then everything is allowed. And who decides when Islam is in danger? Who decides when Christianity is in danger? Who decides that who is an Aryan and who is not? Jews think they are the chosen people of the God. And Adolf Hitler thinks Nordics, the purest Aryans, are the chosen people of God. Now there cannot live two people who think that they are the chosen people of the God. One has to be destroyed. The competitor has to be destroyed. Look at the whole inhuman history of humanity, and you will always find it is obedience to noble causes that has caused immense misery, that has made whole life of humanity a nightmare. You ask me, is it not good to serve obediently in a noble cause? No. Serve only with awareness. Obey only with awareness. Obedience should not be for something exterior. Obedience should be something interior. You should be able to see what is at stake. And you will be able to say yes or no according to your own conscience. Only then the world can become a little better, a little more human. The people who dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, just two persons, they could have said no. It was so 100,000 people who lived in Hiroshima are utterly innocent. Small children, women, old people. Why drop an atom bomb that will destroy them immediately within seconds? Within 10 seconds, Hiroshima was a dead city. Just 10 seconds before, it was alive. It was time. People were taking their supper. People were singing. People were doing all kinds of things. Just a few seconds before, all was so alive. And just after a few moments, whole Hiroshima was just a cemetery. All dead people. The person who dropped the bomb could have said no, but he was obediently serving a noble cause. What was the noble cause? Democracy. These big words are very dangerous, because behind them you can hide anything. Now, in the name of democracy, capitalism hides itself. And in the name of equality, communism hides itself. Watch all big words. And whenever a politician uses a big word, be aware, there must be something fishy about it. And don't go on following. It is better to die. If the man who was going to drop the atom bomb has said no, it was possible, she would have been court-martialed. So what? He could have said, "You kill me." That seems to be a lesser evil. I would like to die, and that would have been a noble cause. You shoot me, but I simply say no, I will not drop this atom bomb to innocent people, on innocent people. The people who were destroying poor Vietnam could have said no. And the same is continuously repeated everywhere, all around the globe. Now it is time we should become more aware. Obedience has been exploited. Obedience has been a very subtle strategy of the politician and the priest. If it comes out of your awareness, if you see that this is good, not that your leaders, your politicians, your priests say good, but you feel it is good, it has to be your response, then do it by all means. But if you see your individual conscience has to decide, that's my whole point. Each individual has to create his consciousness and conscience. Only then we will be able to create a better world. Otherwise, this world is going to commit suicide within 25 years. By the end of this century, this foolish idea of obedience to noble causes is going to destroy whole humanity, and not only humanity, with humanity all life from this earth. All trees, all birds, all animals, all kinds of life, and there are millions of kinds of life on this earth. This earth is a festival. If you go on carrying this stupid idea that has been put into your mind down the ages, throughout the ages, you have been fed with this idea with your mother's milk, obey. I teach you awareness. And of course, out of awareness, a totally different kind of obedience arises. Then you say yes, because your heart says yes. And if your heart says no, then say no. And risk all for your no. That is human dignity. Arthur Koestler writes about an experiment. Meditate over it. A series of highly original experiments were started by Dr. Stanley Milgram. The purpose of the experiments was to discover the limits of the average person's obedience to authority. When ordered to inflict severe pain on an innocent victim in the interests of a noble cause. The noble cause was education. It involved three people. The professor, who was the authority figure in charge of the proceedings, the learner or victim, and the experimental subject, who was asked by the professor to act as teacher
And to punish the learner each time, he gave the wrong reply. Punishment was by electric shocks of growing severity, administered by the teacher on the professor's orders. The learner or victim was strapped into a kind of electric chair. The teacher was seated in front of an impressive shock generator, which had a keyboard of 30 switches, ranging from 15 volts to 450 volts. There were also verbal inscriptions on the machine, ranging from slight shock to intense shock to danger, severe shock. In fact, the victim was an actor. The shock generator was a dummy. Only the teacher at whom the experiment was aimed believed in the reality of the shocks he was ordered to administer, and of the shrieks of pain and cries for mercy uttered by the victim. The basic procedure was as follows. The teacher was given to read a long list of paired words, that is, blue box, nice day, wild duck, etc. Then in the examination, he was given one test word, for instance, blue, with four alternative answers, that is, ink, box, sky, lamp, and had to indicate which was the correct answer. The teacher was instructed by the professor to administer a shock each time the learner gave a wrong response. And moreover, to move one level higher on the shock generator each time the learner gives the wrong answer again. There was 15 volts increment from one switch to the next. To make sure that the teacher was aware of what he was doing, the actor who played the role of the learner uttered complaints which increased in stridency according to the voltage, from mild grunts starting at 75 volts in a crescendo until at 150 volts, the victim cried out, "Get me out of here. I won't be in the experiment anymore. I refuse to go on." Remember that the teacher believed that the victim too was a volunteer. At 315 volts, after a violent scream, the victim reaffirmed vehemently that he was no longer a participant. He provided no answers, but screamed in agony whenever a shock was administered. After 330 volts, he was not heard from. Yet the professor instructed the subject to treat no answer as a wrong answer, and to continue to increase the shock level according to the schedule. After three shocks of 450 volts, he called off the experiment. How many people in an average population do you think would obey the command to carry on with the task of torturing the victim to the limit of 450 volts? The answer seems to be a foregone conclusion, perhaps one in a thousand. A pathological sadist. Before starting his experiments, Milgram actually asked a group of psychiatrists to predict the outcome. With remarkable similarity, they predicted that virtually all subjects would refuse to obey the experimenter. The consensus of the psychiatrists was that most subjects would not go beyond 150 volts. That is, when the victim asks for the first time to be released, they expected that only 4% would reach 300 volts, and that only a pathological fringe of about 1 in a 1,000 would administer the highest shock on the board. In actual fact, over 60% of the subjects
continued to obey the professor to the very end, the 450 volt limit. Remember, 60%. When the experiment was repeated in Italy, South Africa and Australia, the percent of obedient subjects was somewhat higher. In Munich, it was 85%. The act of shocking the victim does not stem from destructive urges, but from the fact that the subjects have become integrated into a social system which is based on obedience. To prove this point, Milgram carried on a further series of experiments in which the teacher was told that he was free to inflict on the learner any shock label of his own choice on any of the trials, though given full opportunity, almost all subjects administered the lowest shocks, the mean shock level being 54 volts. Remember that the victim's first mild complaint came only at 75 volts. In the original experiments, when the teacher acted on orders, an average of 25 out of 40 subjects administered the maximum shock of 450 volts. In the free choice experiment, 38 out of 40 did not go beyond 150 volts. Victims' first loud protest, and only two subjects went up to the 325 and 450 respectively. The vast majority of the subjects, far from deriving any pleasure from shocking the victim, showed various symptoms of emotional strain and distress. Some broke into a sweat, others pleaded with the professor to stop, or protested that the experiment was cruel and stupid, yet two-thirds nevertheless went on to the bitter end. We have been taught for centuries to obey. And to obey in the noble cause is a virtue. To disobey is a vice, is a sin. Disobeying any noble cause will create guilt in you. Obeying will make you feel good. And you may be even obeying it in spite of your own conscience. You will see the futility, the stupidity, the cruelty of it. The man who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima slept very well that night. And in the morning, when he was asked how he is feeling, he said, "Perfect." People could not believe. They said, "Could you sleep in the night?" 100,000 people have been burnt by you. "Could you sleep in the night?" He said, "I slept very well because I had done my duty." And when one does one's duty well, one earns a good sleep. Truman was the president of the United States when the atom bomb was dropped. When he was asked, "How do you feel?" He said, "I feel great. A noble cause has been served. Democracy has won over fascist forces." Remember always, big words are very dangerous. And big words has a very hypnotic power in them. Democracy, God, religion, Bible. Remember, If we want to create a new humanity, we will have to reconsider the whole mind of man. The past has created a very ugly mind. Of course, with beautiful labels, with beautiful painted smiles, and behind is great animality. My emphasis is on the individual, not on the society, not on the nation, not on the religion. My emphasis is on the individual. The individual has to be freed from all kinds of social bondages and slaveries. That's what sannyas is all about. Become aware. And out of your awareness, obedience is good. Disobedience is good. But it has to be rooted in your awareness, then everything is good. And out of unawareness, obedience is bad, disobedience is bad. Let me remind you, I am not telling you to be disobedient, because if it is out of unawareness and you say no, it is as bad as saying yes. I am not teaching you disobedience, disorder, indiscipline. I am not doing that kind of thing at all. I can be misunderstood. I am being misunderstood. What I am saying is, I am making you responsible. The individual is totally responsible whatsoever he is doing. So he has to think, meditate, and act out of your meditations. And whatsoever you do will be virtue, and whatsoever you do will be moral, and it will be a totally different kind of morality. The last question: beloved Bhagwan, this morning when you told the story about the 2 80-year-olds talking on the morning after their wedding night, I let out a whoop of laughter at the punchline. Realizing that I was out of control, I clasped my hand over my mouth and controlled myself. I can't help it. I love to listen you tell stories. I look forward to the next one during discourse. Am I being frivolous? Should I be more serious? Anand Bario, seriousness is illness. Seriousness is pathological. Be sincere, but never be serious. And sincerity is totally different. Seriousness is an assumed, pretended phenomenon. Sincerity is of the heart. Sincerity is a kind of intensity in everything that you do. And it was good that you had a whoop of laughter. Now, hiding it behind your hands is phony, is pseudo. Let it be there. Laughter is good. Good in every way. Physically, psychologically, spiritually. And this is not being frivolous. We have been taught wrong things. That's why people move with long faces in the world. We have been taught utterly wrong things. Christians say Jesus never laughed. Why? And I know that he laughed. I know him perfectly well. But Christians were afraid. Jesus laughing will look frivolous. How can a saint laugh? The saint has to be with a long face. The saints come only with long faces. And in fact, the man who has a long face can never be a saint. Laughter is something of a very superior quality. No other animal except man can laugh. If suddenly on the road you see a buffalo laughing, you will go mad. You will never be the same again. No other animal can laugh except man. It is human dignity that man can laugh. It is human dignity, glory. Laughter is something spiritual. It belongs only to higher stages of intelligence. The more intelligent you are, the more you are capable of laughing at things. Not only at things, but at yourself too. You become capable of seeing the whole grand absurdity of life, this great ridiculousness of life. Christians made Jesus look very sad. That's why paintings of Jesus or sculptures of his face all look a little ugly. They don't have that joy that is expressed by Krishna, his flute, his dance. They don't have that laughter that you will see in Bodhidharma's pictures, Lao Tzu's pictures. They don't have that superb quality that you will find in a genius like Chuang Tzu, the genius of the absurd. Jesus must have laughed because he was a very earthly man. He loved good food. He loved good company. He loved people. He ate well. And he also was a drunkard. Now a drunkard and not laughing? That is impossible. And he must be telling jokes. Believe me, a drunkard and not telling jokes. The gospel writers must have dropped them. Even my editors sometimes feel that this is too much. Unprintable. But I don't allow them to drop anything. Gospels were written after Jesus died, 300 years afterwards. So the editors had absolute freedom to do whatsoever they wanted. I know beautiful jokes have been dropped. Jesus was a Jew. And Jews have the best jokes of the world. Barrio, Don't be worried about frivolousness. And sometimes even to be frivolous is beautiful. Even to be frivolous sometimes has a grandeur about it, a weightlessness, a beauty, a benediction. I accept life in all its colors, the whole rainbow, from frivolousness to sincerity. Just for you, I will tell two jokes. Finkelstein's father was very unhappy because his son regularly did the two things that a good Jew is not supposed to do: eat ham and go with non-Jewish women. Finally, he complained to the rabbi. "Rabbi," he cried, "I don't know what to do. Whenever my son Ezra sees some ham, he immediately sinks his teeth into it. And when he sees a non-Jewish girl, he hugs and kisses her." So Ezra had to go and see the rabbi. "What is this your father tells me?" demanded the rabbi in a loud voice. "You sink your teeth into ham sandwiches and kiss Christian girls? What is the matter with you?" "Rabbi, what can I do?" said Ezra apologetically. "I am crazy." "Nonsense," said the rabbi. "If you bit into the girl and kissed the ham sandwich, then you would be crazy. But as things are, everything is in order, and you are perfectly normal. Just don't do it anymore." And the second, there was this owner-operator of a bar who was constantly besieged with requests from his male customers for the names of prostitutes and their whereabouts. One day he decided it was stupid not to tap into this source of income. So he went and got a couple of girls and installed them in a couple of rooms over the bar. Whenever a customer wanted a girl, he merely sent them upstairs. A couple of days after this new business began, a customer returned from upstairs very unhappy and complained to the man about the lousy blowjob he had just had. The owner ordered the man to follow him back upstairs, called for the three girls who were working together in the bedroom, told the man to get back on the bed, turned to the girls and said, "Okay, girls, I am going to show you now how, just one more time, so damn it, get it right." Don't be worried about frivolousness. That is part of life. And a real life contains all. It has all the nuances, all the notes and all the colors. So, Barrio, you can have a good laughter. No need to hide it. I would like my place to be a place of laughter, joy, festivity. I want to be a festival to you. Enough for today.